Listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, I'm Morgan Quaintance and this is Studio Visit. Now, in the field of contemporary art, the subject of aesthetics has, for some time, been in a state of arrested development. On one hand, reactionary moralists cling to the ballasts of beauty and mimesis when judging the entire corpus of post-conceptual work since the 1960s. And on the other, artists and theorists skirt around the subject as the discussion of aesthetics since Kant's critique of judgment has mostly been usurped by societal, structural, and systemic critiques offered by continental theory and its offshoots. However, the work of my guest this week arrived at the beginning of this century to give critical discourse on aesthetics the enlivening shot in the arm it needed. Cien Ngai is the author of a trilogy of three books that considers the developments of aesthetic and aesthetic categories under late capitalism. Ugly Feelings, released in 2005, considers the connotations of non-cathartic effects, feelings basically, that lead to a kind of emotional and intellectual inertia like envy, irritation and anxiety. Our Aesthetic Categories, released in 2012, argues that the zany, the cute and the interesting are the forms of judgment we use to process contemporary experience. And finally, Theory of the Gimmick, published this year, considers the gimmick as a kind of overarching judgment and creative device that reveals something essential about the economic and existential conditions created by late capitalism. For me, Ngai's unofficial trilogy is a landmark work that is both a challenging and rewarding read. But more than that, it's an essential entry into the canon of aesthetic theory and a call to pursue the possibilities of deep and considered analysis. Okay, so I'd like to start by going back to Ugly Feelings, or at least the beginning of the writing of Ugly Feelings. Did you realise then that you'd started an investigation into aesthetics that would span 15 years and three books?
To be honest, no. It felt when I was writing that book, which is essentially my dissertation, that I was already coming to the party a bit late. So at the time, there was affect theory was what just was this thing. And it was mostly people like Brian Massumi, Lawrence Grossberg, who were coming at the question of affect, bringing it back to cultural studies from a kind of Deleuzean perspective. And the argument here was that affect needed to be taken seriously. And part of the carrier of this argument was, interestingly, that affect needed to be taken seriously because it's opposed in some ways to emotion. So the idea is that emotions were bound up with narrative and coherent identities and were kind of conservative. And then affect was this way of talking about intensity and feeling that was kind of about the body and was going to move away from. So this is kind of an odd way to go about it, because at that time, it also seemed like emotion itself and all the categories of emotion, like passions, moods, whatever, were all kind of missing from the study of literary criticism and theory, in particular my field. And that's because of the huge influence of structuralism and semiotics still, you know. So at the time, it felt like I was already doing something slightly deviant in actually talking about feelings in a way that kind of didn't really worry about the distinction so much between affects and emotions, but actually thought about the ways in which those two categories kind of cross each other all the time, or you have these sort of like unnamed, unspecified, amorphous intensities that then kind of coagulate into kind of more structured or scripted feelings, and then feelings that kind of move in the other direction. So anyway, so aesthetics wasn't really so much at the forefront. It was really about making a very, like, it seemed kind of like a small intervention in affect studies, which has since, you know, become this huge thing, and people are still working on that. And of course, the terrain of that has shifted in a way too, where I think the original kind of like tension that really motivated people like Brian Massumi in bringing the field forward. I'm not sure that opposition is as meaningful as it was back then, where it seemed to really, you know, jumpstart the whole conversation. So yeah, so Ugly Feelings kind of enters the field of affect studies. And another important early person here was Lauren Berlant, who was also very unique in the way she was thinking about affects in the public sphere. But yeah, so Ugly Feelings, yeah, I didn't know that this was going to open up into the other books. And I guess the way in which it did is just simply taking seriously the seemingly trivial and kind of everyday feelings that did not seem morally prestigious and that did not seem to be cathartic in the way that would lend themselves to, you know, other kinds of literature or culture. And so then the next book, our aesthetic categories, all the aesthetic categories in that book are based on ambivalent or conflicting feelings, right? So the cute is a kind of mix of tenderness and aggression. The zany involves a kind of like uncertainty about whether something is play or work or fun or not fun even. And the interesting is always sliding into its opposite. So I think, I'm not sure I could have written the second book without the first book, but no, I didn't know.
One of the things that struck me when reading Theory of the Gimmick and then looking back again at Ugly Feelings and our aesthetic categories is, I guess, how neglected the discipline of aesthetics and I guess, hermeneutics and then again, affect theory is in my own field. That is the field of contemporary art. So, I mean, there's rarely any space for sort of real analysis aside from like surface level descriptions like in reviews or small features in journals. I mean, we rely mostly on books for like deep expository events, but they seldom come. So some people might not lament this, but I wondered what you felt was important about deep aesthetic analysis and what maybe it contributes to, say, visual culture in a broader sense.
Yeah, I actually, I'm glad you're saying this. And in a way, it's to the credit of contemporary art, because I personally think, and this, I'm speaking now as someone who actually is engaged in this field, but that actually aesthetic theory is sort of conservative. You know, I don't think it's an accident that contemporary artists have not been going there. I don't think it's an accident that hasn't been a major discourse, because, and again, I'm saying this as a practitioner, I guess, it is a kind of like old-fashioned, you know, what I'm thinking about here is like, just like if you look at like journals of aesthetic theory, because they're so focused still on beauty as kind of a paradigmatic example of, you know, aesthetic experience and judgment, because there's something that seems so kind of stiff and unexciting about the question of aesthetic judgment. And so, I mean, I don't think it is. I think actually the aesthetic judgment, if one thinks about it as a kind of performative utterance, and if actually even one goes back to Kant and actually realizes how he in the Critique of Judgment is showing you what a strange kind of mental and verbal action this thing is, I mean, it's utterly fascinating. But something about the way that discourse has been kind of like produced is, I guess the exceptions here are like the Marxist, like Adorno, but even, you know, aesthetic theory is not like a fun read, you know, so.
But that's what seems to me to be still quite radical about your undertaking, is that you realized, so I think there's something wrong whenever you look into a field, you have to go right back to say 17th or 18th century, you know, like, so if as soon as you start to talk about value in terms of aesthetics or how we might make some assessments about the quality or lack of about a work of art, and as soon as people go back to Kant, you know, you realize, okay, there's a problem here. You know, why hasn't it evolved since then? And that's why what was so thrilling and radical still about all three of these books is that you took up the baton where people had sort of cautiously skirted around it, you know.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I actually find Kant himself extremely fascinating. But I know what you mean, and you know what it is. I think we're both talking about here is I've been using the word sort of conservative or reactionary, but like aesthetic discourse is really moralizing, right? I mean, that's one of the kind of downsides that happens when you limit your grasp of what's happening in aesthetic experience to one basic category or maybe two, right? I mean, not all of our aesthetic experiences and categories have a kind of ethical layer to them. And maybe beauty does, but I think that limitation has kind of made the entire conversation about aesthetics just about making moralizations, right? And I don't really know so much where contemporary arts is right now, but I know that my field has actually gotten super conservative over the last 10 years. And people want to bring all the old shit back. You know, they want to talk about beauty and value. And I don't find the making of those judgments interesting at all. What I find important and interesting is to actually think more analytically about what is happening with specific judgments. And so here, just even making things concrete. So let's just talk about a concrete judgment that people use every day, you know, which is cute. What if we actually took that a little bit more seriously, given that it's such a common judgment? It seems to, in some ways, have displaced the judgment of the beautiful from everyday conversation. Like, what are actually people recognizing about the world that we share when they call different things cute, you know? And I think as soon as you start to move away from the participation and kind of like acts of moralized evaluation concerning art and actually think about, you know, the specific and concrete kinds of judgments that people use. And it's important here because the concreteness is important because we only have a certain repertoire of categories because we are historical subjects. And we live in a historical culture, you know, and that culture is going to generate, I guess what I'm basically saying is that aesthetic experience, it is a really rich domain where people process things about the world that they live in a way that's different from the way we process them in other domains. Like, I think it's really important to remember that the aesthetic can be this place where we actually grasp something, even about like something as abstract as the capitalist mode of production, you know, in our ordinary interactions with people in which we share our pleasures and displeasures with them. If the aesthetic really were what I think a lot of philosophers still want to make it into, which is this kind of truncated, narrow space, it would be too boring to work on. But happily, like it's a place where people actually are doing a lot of thinking, and where thinking and feeling actually interact constantly in all sorts of fascinating ways.
Okay, so I think let's get into the book now. Let's get into the newest book, which is The Theory of the Gimmick. I had a lot of fun reading this book, and I was by turns enthralled and sometimes a little bit terrified. And we're going to get into why I was terrified soon. But the first thing to say about the book, let's just sort of orient listeners a little bit. So the first thing to say about the book is that you're characterizing the gimmick as both an aesthetic judgment and maybe an aesthetic device. Is that fair?
That's right. So the gimmick is both a form that we perceive in the world. It's a form that many different things can take on. So like you can find it in a kitchen device, or you can find it in a political statement. It can really be anywhere. And it's also the verbal evaluation, the verbal concept that we attach to that form.
And then as a judgment, our criteria for labeling something a gimmick is that it either tries too hard or too little to achieve its desired effect. So you're right, we call things gimmicks when it becomes radically uncertain if they are working too hard or too little, if they are historically backward or just problematically advanced, if they are wonders or tricks. So what is it about the gimmick that gives it this propensity for producing ambivalence?
Well, it comes from the fact that the gimmick is a product, the gimmick is specific to a product of capitalism. And it's also an aesthetic response to the other products of capitalism, commodities, basically, in a system where the production and realization of this thing called value is bound up with labor and tied to a kind of abstraction of labor, which in turn binds the concept of labor to the concept of time. So the gimmick is a kind of aesthetic response, again, to any artifact that's made in this world where production happens in this way, where commodities are produced and commodities acquire value. And this is a system that is itself full of massive contradictions, which is why, since the kind of like maturation of capitalism in the 19th century, capitalism is always plagued with crises, and where we see these contradictions kind of constantly playing out. There are so many ways in which you can kind of see this happening. One way is the way in which the very health and stability of capitalism ends up producing often a kind of systemic generation of unemployment, right? Where competition between different capitalists in a single branch of production produces this general kind of pressure to introduce labor-saving, quote-unquote, innovations in the process, which often end up expelling workers who can't really be absorbed into the new lines of production, creating what Karl Marx called surplus populations, by which he meant that people whose relationship to the wage would kind of become permanently insecure. And of course, like imperialism and the kind of history of like racist forms of extraction from other places in the globe have also produced populations who have an uncertain relation to the wage or who end up being kind of barred from the wage. In any case, you have this systematic tendency for capitalism to kind of shuck off labor. But at the same time, labor, and particularly surplus labor, which is kind of unpaid labor, is the only way in which the system can actually grow. So you have this massive contradiction where the very thing that you need to produce growth and accumulation, and one of the other things about capitalism is if it does not grow, it falls apart, right? It has to actually, it can't be still. The very thing that produces the accumulation is actually underpinning the whole system. And that's why we have this very familiar thing, which is crisis. So the gimmick is a product of this mature crisis-prone capitalist culture. And the ambivalences that you pointed out in that sentence you quoted, so these are all ambivalences about three specific things. There's an uncertainty about labor, right? Like how much labor, like, you know, is this thing work, like this thing seems to be working too much or too hard. There's an uncertainty about value. Is it a wonder or a trick? And there's an uncertainty also about the timing, the social timing of the form. So my favorite example in illustrating the uncertainty about the timing of the gimmick is Google Glass. Just because even as we're talking right now in 2020, Google Glass, I think, still makes people giggle a little bit because many of us remember what a flop that thing was when it first was introduced to consumer markets in 2012, with, of course, lots of gimmicks. I think like one of the people from the corporation, like they jumped out of a plane, they had like a fashion show, and there was this whole like kind of promotion of the smart glasses. And it was a huge flop. People didn't like the product. There was all these lawsuits about people objecting to being filmed by Google Glass. And so then Google Glass kind of disappeared. But since then, actually, has unostentatiously come back, but no longer as a kind of like fashion accessory or like gadget, you know, high-end gadget that a consumer might buy, but actually as a tool for production in factories now, like Boeing, I think, uses Google Glass, and it's been renamed, of course. I think it's just called Glass. It's renamed, and I think because they knew that brand was a little toxic from before, and I think also in warehouses where the workers who are wearing the glasses need to have both of their hands free, but also need information coming in very quickly. So you can imagine that I'm not sure if it literally is happening, but I think in Amazon, like warehouses, you know, where people need to kind of move quickly and also have a lot of logistical stuff coming in right on time, that the glasses actually would be useful. So here's a classic situation where something that seemed badly timed, and you know, it seemed like, you know, it was like the Google Glass was too futuristic. Like nobody wanted to wear it. It was just like, now suddenly becomes an ordinary tool in the workplace. This undecidability, this question of whether or not the commodity is worth it. This is actually just this points to basically the overarching instability of the gimmick form, right? The fact that this is what I find so fascinating about the gimmick is that the gimmick always is connected to the potential of it not being a gimmick.
I'm glad you were sort of talking about the economic ramifications of the gimmick or the way it's tied into the sort of Marxist economic angle. But what I kind of wanted to talk to you about now also is what I feel was the book's shadow. Now, in some ways, the book is exploring the sort of economic reality of the use of the gimmick. But I felt that there was an existential aspect to the gimmick as well, which was in the book, but may not necessarily be explicitly voiced. Usually in a book like this, you start off with a concept that you feel you know just through everyday usage, like a gimmick. I understand what a gimmick is. It's something they use in showbiz to sort of help someone stand out more than they usually do. And I thought one of my examples was, well, Jimi Hendrix. So when Jimi Hendrix first began, he used to play the guitar behind his back and with his teeth. And then that became his kind of gimmick. But then I thought, well, there's a danger also in the gimmick, which is that the gimmick can then like devour you. Your use of the gimmick then becomes something of a kind of albatross that you're recognized for and also demanded to reproduce. And then you may enter into this sort of odd situation with your chosen gimmick, which means you want to transcend it, but you can't, you're stuck with it. And I also thought that this more existential side of the use of the gimmick came through in your analysis of two things in the book, two sections that I found really, really thrilling as a reader. Your analysis of Robert Louis Stevenson's The Bottle Imp, which is a short story, I think.
Yeah.
And then also the film It Follows. Now, if it's fair for me to go down this existential route with you, or what I'm calling the existential route, could we start by, could you give a short description of The Bottle Imp? And then I've got some questions I want to ask you about it.
No, I actually think the existential reading of the gimmick, as you describe it, is connected to the Marxist reading. But I think they're actually quite related. So The Bottle Imp is a short fiction that Robert Louis Stevenson wrote close to the turn of the century, at a moment where there was a lot of media attention actually to banking crises. And it's a story about a native Hawaiian who discovers a magic bottle. It's passed on to him by an old man who says that the bottle will grant the user whatever wish the user desires. And interestingly, in the case of the main character of this story, the desire that he has is for real estate. So there's a kind of desire here for a form of social insurance through real estate as a kind of like, the only way apparently to get this. But the bottle has a catch, and the catch is that the bottle has to be sold before the death of the user. If the user still possesses the bottle at the time of his or her death, they will go to hell. But there's another catch too, which is that the bottle has to be sold for less money than for which it was paid. So basically what this bottle kind of is, as other critics have pointed out, is it's basically a credit card. And it's basically a credit card where the cost of the credit sinks. So it's a kind of promise of incredibly cheap credit. Now, of course, there's the going to hell problem, right? So the guy starts to use the bottle, and, you know, the bottle's kind of shady. The story has some kind of like remnants of a classic fairy tale. You know, like, I think there's a version of this in American folk culture called like the monkey's paw, where the thing that gives you the wish is granted, but with some kind of like evil kind of like layer to it. So he gets his house. But he gets the house only after his uncle dies. And he starts to not like the bottle, and he decides to sell it. So he sells it, and he's like, okay, good. I don't have to worry about that anymore. I got the house. And he falls in love, and he wants to get married. And then he realizes that he has syphilis. And he needs the bottle back to cure this, at the time, an incurable disease. So he has to track down the bottle. And since he sold the bottle's been kind of passed on through different hands. And he finally finds the bottle in the hands of a kind of dissipated criminal who says, okay, I'll give you the bottle back, but unfortunately I can only sell it to you for like 2 cents or whatever. And so now the protagonist is like, shoot, because he's put in a bind where he, in order to get the bottle to cure his syphilis, to marry his love, he has to buy the bottle at a price where he can only sell it for, sorry, the arithmetic now is mixing me up, but like, you know, he can only, he buys it for 1 cent. Now he can't sell it anymore. Right. So he's like, well, I love her so much. I don't care. I guess I'll just go to hell. So he marries his wife and then he finally confesses to her this whole situation and why he can't actually be happy in the marriage, because he's haunted by the fact that he's going to go to hell because he can't sell this bottle. And his wife says, hey, look, you know, we live in a global system. There are other currencies in this world that are smaller than the cent. For example, in France, they have the centime, you know, and the centime is like, you know, you can carve up a cent even into smaller and smaller bits.
Yeah. And I think like what people, listeners might be thinking, oh, this sounds like a sort of the usual sort of Faustian contract, but it's not, because it keeps evolving. It keeps shifting every time the protagonist tries to get out of the situation. It becomes more complex, and he becomes more intimately bound into what seems to be an impending doom. Now, I think you were right. Like, I may have explained it wrong, as if like I discovered this notion of like the sort of existential ramifications of the gimmick in the book. I didn't. They're in the book. But I guess what I'm saying is the way it unfolds in the book, it unfolds. This may be a stretch, but to me, it felt like it unfolded in the same way, the same creeping way. It kept reappearing underneath the analysis of value and labor and sort of Marxist terms of abstraction. It kept surfacing again in the same way that this bottle imp keeps having to be exchanged. Or when we talk about this next analysis in the film, it follows that this murderous phantom keeps appearing for people who are who it's been passed on to. So that might not make much sense to listeners, but hopefully it makes sense to Sian.
It totally makes sense to me. And I actually think that, thanks for saying it's in the book, but you do bring it out in a helpful way, just in the way that the gimmick sometimes can flip into a non-gimmick. And one of the things that, again, that is distinctive about the gimmick, but I think is also historically distinctive to every commodity in capitalism, is this uncertainty about where value is purported to be. But just like the gimmick can flip into the non-gimmick at any kind of particular moment, and again, Google Glass is a great example of this, gimmicks can sometimes, yeah, be tools that we use to survive. And actually, the book opens really thinking about this sort of paradox, like in that great Sondheim musical number, right, where the strippers are saying, you got to get a gimmick if you want to make it in this business. The gimmick is a tool. It's a tool and it's useful. But then at a certain point, as you kind of implied, you're the tool. And the thing that you thought you could use to move forward or get by or survive or get a big fat cigar, to quote Stephen Sondheim, is actually dangerous. So the gimmick can actually be dangerous. And I think that's what you're getting at with the existential, what you're calling the existential reading. That is absolutely true. And that, I actually like the way you're putting it. And that is kind of bound up with the system that the gimmick is a product of.
And then it feels sort of, even if you wind them, pan out even more, then the entire gimmick is just capitalism itself. You know, that we're fooled into thinking that self-emancipation comes through participation in this system that exploits some, and maybe not you if you're lucky. But then does it really? You know, can you ever, you know? And so in some ways, when I was reading this book, I felt like, wow, this is the bleakest of the three, you know?
You know, I'm so glad you're seeing this, because that really is the revelation of the book. I mean, that the gimmick, I mean, in a way that I think, like, it's almost kind of embarrassing, like, because, you know, I was trained early on in all these ways to be like not a crude Marxist. One of the most influential books in my intellectual development was probably Fred Jameson's The Political Unconscious. And that book begins with all these ways in which not to do Marxist criticism. And of course, you know, this sort of like boogeyman of like, you know, the crude, vulgar Marxist. And it's so funny writing this book. I was like, look, guys, I can't help it. That's what this thing is about. Like, I mean, like every layer of the analysis, I just kept, I was like, well, that actually is just like you just said, Morgan. I mean, it really is a product of the same system that is really, you know, quote unquote, about the system's most basic laws. I mean, even going back to the fact that, look, we don't really have any other aesthetic concepts that are explicitly about the connections between value, time, and labor. There's no other aesthetic category that really, you know, fuses these three things together in exactly the way that our economic system, the one that, you know, dominates the entire world, even if the entire world doesn't participate in it, just does the same. So yeah, I'm actually glad you put it that way. I have to say to listeners, it was almost a surprise, you know, because the gimmick is fundamentally not itself an economic thing. It's an aesthetic thing, right? It's an aesthetic form and aesthetic perception. It's not reducible to an economic category, but it's kind of like touching on the economic at every point. At some point, I had to actually just embrace this because instead of being, you know, kind of nervous that I would be seen as a kind of, you know, vulgar Marxist, but hey, look, there you go. You know, this is, I can't help it. This thing is about this.
Well, I'm glad you embraced your vulgar side because, like, it's produced a really brilliant text, I think. Now, could we go on to talking about one of my favorite sections in the book, please? So this is your analysis of the film It Follows. So just to set this up, this is a film. The film It Follows is like a kind of horror film. It's a film about a kind of, like I said before, a murderous phantom that is passed on to people through sex. So the idea is that one person who is stalked by this killer phantom has to have sex with someone else during a specific period of time. And then that phantom is then passed on to this other person. But then this other person then has to find someone else to sleep with so that they can too pass on the murderous phantom to someone else. So in order for people to stop themselves being killed by this thing that stalks them, they have to keep sleeping with people. Now, a lot of, you know, people took the bait and saw this mostly as a cautionary tale about sexual promiscuity. But your analysis, I think, was simply fantastic and virtuosic. Could you talk a little bit about how you read this?
Yeah, my reading of this film is that it is about sex, but it's also an allegory of circulation and about credit. And about how, as people found out during the subprime mortgage crisis in 2007, 2008, that our debts, our student loans, our car debts, our mortgages were being cut up in little pieces and kind of resold and passed around without anyone knowing it. So the kids in this film, and, you know, it's not an accident either. I don't think that the film is set in Detroit, a very white Detroit. So it's kind of like a, you know, very one-sided Detroit, but suburban white Detroit, but like, you know, that people were all, their debts were being passed around and resold, and that everybody without knowing it was kind of facing the consequences of the default of loans without having consciously signed up for that. So people find themselves embedded in this kind of larger structure of which they were unaware, because the people who have sex in this movie don't know that they're, you know, now obligated to basically continue passing on and continue circulating, you know, quote, the curse, right? So yeah, that's the reading of the film. And I'm really glad that you pointed out that comment, because it really does nail what I think the film is actually about, which is this hidden circulating debt that must continue circulating.
I mean, yeah, and when I read it, this is what I mean about analysis, really considered deep analysis, missing from a lot of criticism or a lot of writing about cultural production that I'm reading. And it made me realize how much I miss it and how much I want to try to refocus my writing to do more of it.
It's good to hear because so writing this book, I have to tell you, was on one hand very pleasurable and exciting, partly because it feels very satisfying to kind of realize that people are that people actually know a lot and that in a way that's reflected in kind of our most ordinary expressions and judgments, you know, that there is a kind of processing of something very complex and abstract that ordinary people do all the time, you know. And so there's something very gratifying about realizing that, hey, people are like smarter, you know, than we seem, even when we are calling something a gimmick in a kind of like casual way in a discussion that we're having about, you know, whatever products at Best Buy or like a novel on a bus, that we're actually kind of accurately registering something about our economic system and its incredible, you know, contradictions and paradoxes and like all these things that the gimmick kind of shows us, you know, that there's a kind of like that how it sits on this edge between something that is, that it's always about like our uncertainty about, you know, things are as valuable as they purport to be, or whether something that's so as trivial as a commodity actually is kicking your ass everyday life. That's pleasurable. The part that was kind of difficult though was I kept laughing at this at myself because I was like, okay, like you're basically working on an aesthetic form that is announcing itself as not worthy of attention. Because you're working on an aesthetic form that is, by definition, unworthy. And I had to laugh at myself because I was like, ah, the gimmick is something that almost punishes you for working on it. But it also, the gimmick has this comedic side to it. I think a lot of the examples in the book, like It Follows and The Bottle M, sit on this edge between forms that are comedic and horrific.
That's definitely something I felt throughout the whole book. Even from your examples at the beginning, the early ones where you talk about the James Baldwin essay and the book The Wig, you sort of introduced the tragedy there. And then even towards the end, I think the examples of conceptual art for me always has this sort of twin side to it. You know, like there's something kind of banal about it, but also something kind of horrific about some of the flatness and banality that can come through. So I definitely felt that throughout the whole, and then of course the Henry James chapter at the end, which I'm going to have to return to because unfortunately I'm not as well read in James's whatever as I perhaps should be, but I can tell that's sort of waiting for me once I've done the legwork, you know.
No, I'm so glad to hear you say that. Yeah, it's something that I kind of point that out as an aside, but. It could have been highlighted, I think, this horror comedy, the horror comedy thing, because also I think it again reflects that the structure of the gimmick, and I think is kind of what you mean by the existential thing, which is again like we're talking about the same thing. And the other example of that is like the Stan Douglas piece, right, Suspiria, which is literally Stan Douglas's reenactment of the Dario Argento horror film, which of course itself had elements of certain campiness already was showing how horror and comedy sit in a comfortably closed space sometimes. But yeah, the Baldwin example, The Wig, which is a pretty unknown text by actually a writer who I think someone should work more on because he's really interesting, Charles Stevenson Wright. He's really someone who's fallen out of the literary canon. He's fallen out of the African-American literary canon. He's fallen out of the post-45 American canon, but a super interesting writer. And, you know, both of those texts also really underscore how impossible it is to talk about aesthetic forms and economic forms and capitalism without also talking about race. So I'm glad you brought up the Baldwin and the Stevenson Wright. But yeah, horror and comedy, that's yet another one of these kind of paradoxes that the gimmick flaunts for us.
And, you know, one of the last things I mean wanted to ask or talk about or just bring up was the gimmick's affinity with conceptual art, basically. So yeah. You didn't mention Sol LeWitt, but Sol LeWitt, basically, he could have been one of your examples of the sort of proto-conceptualization of the gimmick, yeah? So in this essay he wrote for Art Forum in 1967, sort of infamous essay called Paragraphs on Conceptual Art, there's a couple of lines in it and they go like this. So LeWitt first says, conceptual art. So in conceptual art, the idea becomes a machine that makes art. And I thought, oh my God, that's the gimmick. And then the second one is conceptual artists are mystics rather than rationalists, which I felt chimed with, you know, the sex passages on magic in the book.
Oh, yeah.
Something about conceptual art itself has the sort of comedy, horror aspect.
Oh, that's really cool. I know that with SF, but it didn't really struck me how, like, you know, right on it is. That's hilarious. You know, there's this chapter in the book on the Norwegian photographer Torben Rudland, who does a kind of conceptual photography, where he has, I think he also wrote like a kind of riff on the paragraphs on conceptual art. I think it's like sentences about photography. And one of the things that he riffs on is, if I remember correctly, the LeWitt text had a line in it that said something like, it's impossible to bungle a good idea or something like that. And then I think Rudland in his text says something like, good ideas are easily bungled. His photography to me is actually, it's kind of like an investigation of what you just described. Like, it is kind of an owning, you could say, of this gimmick problem that conceptual art has always had, right? And trying to actually like kind of move into that a little bit and embrace that and basically make photographs that are basically bungled ideas. So what I do in that chapter is, let me just explain. It's hard to write because I feel like I had to kind of do a loop around the normal discussion that comes up always with conceptual art and gimmicks, even though that word is actually carefully like not used by people in that discussion, which is that the anxiety about conceptual art is about, it's an anxiety about questions of authorship or artistic value and
labor and time, you know, like there's always that issue of like, well, how much labor has been expended in you?
Yeah.
You know, just to cite my Martin Creed, who's an artist here who won the Turner Prize for one of the works that was in his Turner Prize show, was a light that was switched off and on in a room, you know, so people were saying, well, how is this? Where's the labor? Where's the mimesis? What's going on?
In a way, this is what I'm talking about. But I had to sort of find a way to talk about it without, well, okay, let me just say that. So my approach to it in the book was to actually move away from the art examples into the literary kind of, equivalent of conceptual art for literature people, which is the novel of ideas, quote unquote, right?
Yeah, this is also another incredible bit of analysis.
Oh, you mean the Magic Mountain stuff?
Yeah.
Well, so I found the perfect literary example, which is Nicola Barker wrote this stunt novel in 2003 that is about a really shitty work of conceptual art, if I may say so. In 2003, the magician, the American popular magician David Blaine, did a conceptual performance piece in London where he starved himself in public in a transparent box that was hung under a crane in you may have to help me here with the London geography, in a kind of park, Porter's Field. Is that correct?
I can't remember. I think it was somewhere like on the river. Like, I can't really remember. I think it was definitely in one of the parks, one of the more public parks, like somewhere like Hyde Park or maybe somewhere on the South Bank. But I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, it's like definitely it's near the river. I think it's kind of near a very kind of corporately built up part of London with the egg, perhaps is maybe. I'm going to embarrass myself here.
That's basically the South. That's sort of the South Bank is like the Manhattan skyline bit. You know, you can just walk across it and you come to Parliament, the London Eye, and all those kind of architectural landmarks that London.
Yeah.
Well, they're all pretty banal on average, but that London is, you can recognize it by, you know.
Yeah, maybe Potter's Field. But anyway, Barker wrote this novel very quickly. And the timing of the novel writing almost coincided with the timing of the performance piece. So basically, he lasted as long as he could, which was, I think, a little over a month. So the story that fascinated Barker and compelled her to write the novel is that British media was obsessed with Blaine, but it was obsessed also with showing people obsessed with Blaine. And there was a lot of antagonism towards this this conceptual artwork. And it took the form of, you know, some hateful stuff where people would like throw things at him, and they would like, you know, they would fly drones with like hamburgers around him. It became this huge media spectacle also where he had all these like lovers and like fans. And
no, I remember.
You remember this? Yeah.
I remember. Yeah. I remember just thinking he was a bit of an idiot, but yeah, I remember.
So basically this question, like this gimmick hovers over London, and whatever you want to say about whether or not the thing or this gimmick is hovering over London. And what I think the novel really shows us, the reason why the novel is interesting is it's a novel of ideas, but it's because the entire novel is basically kind of shows how this temporary, let's say very aesthetically dubious performance ends up kind of making everyone talk. And so people kind of gather around the object, and they form these communities, or like these groups at least. And the entire novel is kind of about aesthetic judgments. So the gimmick here ends up being an object of aesthetic suspicion and distrust that actually ends up producing all these kinds of sociality. You know, and Barker's interested in those temporary forms of intense sociality that are produced by the presence of the gimmick. And so it's an example of, and it's a conceptual artwork or post-conceptual. It does sound like you know, the problem with the piece was it was seen as incredibly bad taste, right? I mean, you're basically starving yourself in public right around the beginning of the Iraq War, too. But the interesting thing about that novel, though, and this is a bit wacky, and I think you can only really see this if you're really into the novel, which I am. But I found the whole stunt of the novel. The novel itself is conceptual in a way that mirrors the box. So it's like Barker is flirting, it seems like. She's kind of flirting with the gimmick form and kind of experimenting with it. And that's one of the things that I realized too, like just like a lot of my examples in the book were kind of on the edge between comedy and horror. Most of them were artworks where you could tell that the gimmick was something that the artist, I mean, no one wants their work to be a gimmick, right? It's a bad thing. Still, the form itself, if one looks at it objectively and at a distance, is fascinating enough and culturally like rich enough that you can see why artists ranging from Poe to Duchamp to Barker not only meditate on what this form is, but let's actually use it.
Well, I think now it is. Now that you've written Theory of the Gimmick, it has been revealed to us as something worthy of attention and as a suitably complex form that might add a layer of intensity to whatever it is that you're doing. I certainly am going to dabble with it, but I'm going to be careful about what I do.
Oh, that's so great. Well, you have to tell me what happens, okay? But yes, now you know all the dangers, right?
Okay, so with that in mind, I want to ask my last question. And I'm wondering, you know, I read an interview with you about this book, and I've read a couple of sort of reviews about the text. I thought you'd be inundated with this question, but nobody seems to have asked it. And the question is, writing a book about the theory of the gimmick, and wondering about yourself as a person who has been writing about aesthetics for 3 books now, Do you yourself worry that somebody may say, oh, is your gimmick that you write about aesthetics or effect? And maybe this is a way of me asking, is this going to be the last book? Is there going to be one more in the series, or is the trilogy complete now?
Yeah, I feel like it's complete now. So yeah, the argument in aesthetic categories was that there are really just these 3 aesthetic concepts that are especially important for kind of grasping our contemporary moment, which are the cute, the interesting, and the zany. And the reason why is because, well, there's many reasons why, but one quick reason is that each of these aesthetic kind of experiences and judgments actually indexes like a large kind of socially binding process that takes place in capitalism. So the cute is about consumption, you know, the interesting is about circulation, and the zany is about work and production. But then the gimmick kind of like is about the overarching process of valorizing the commodities that our system produces that really joins those 3 processes together. So kind of like, which is not to say that like the book is closed on capitalism and aesthetic forms. I mean, there's so much more to say, and there's also, of course, many, especially now, right? Our culture loves to kind of multiply and pluralize and produce new forms of aesthetic experiences and concepts. You know, I can't even keep up. So it's not like there's kind of an end to this topic by any means. It's in the nature of the system to kind of keep generating novel aesthetic forms. But I just feel like the gimmick ends up being so surprisingly big. And of course, like everything I say about it, like the irony is never lost on me, that I'm saying this thing that is definitionally stupid. You know, the gimmick is a stupid thing. It's like a stupid, annoying, trivial thing is big in the sense that it actually indexes something very fundamental and basic about our world. But that also is, it's also something quite, I'll just say deep, you know, I mean, deep enough that like, and deep and not only deep, but like not necessarily obvious. This is what's so wonderful about reading Marx is that like, he's actually showing you how capitalism basically seals exploitation and the fact that it happens and, you know, why it happens and to whom it happens to, it conceals it like in its most ordinary economic category. So like the wage seems like what you get paid for, you know, the hours you work, but actually is not that at all. And so forth. So the gimmick touched on something large and but also kind of deep and not necessarily obvious, which is the way in which wealth in our society is produced by unpaid labor. You know, there's no way getting around that, but like that's not obvious either. And what's great about the gimmick is, or what's exciting about it is that you realize that in a funny way, people already know this. Even if they don't read Marx, people kind of already know this because the contradictions that the gimmick encodes are about this, right? The way, again, it connects these sort of metrics concerning labor, time, and value. So I find that incredibly heartening to think that like there is a kind of like popular kind of critique that people do, and you don't have to necessarily be an intellectual or to have read, you know, again, Capital to really, to have already in some ways recognized this situation and to be also expressing that recognition in the way you share your pleasures with other people. That makes me happy because, you know, there's a kind of like tendency to see critique and pleasure and aesthetic pleasure in particular as opposites, like one is the enemy of the other. And to me, the fact that people call things gimmicks, not only do they call things gimmicks angrily, they call things gimmicks with amusement. You know, it can be actually really fun to debate whether or not, and very galvanizing of certain things, very exciting to have debates about whether or not, let's say, this man hanging over London getting skinnier for 30 days, like what is the worth of this thing? What is this exactly? You know. So yeah, I don't know, Morgan. I think I feel like, in a way, I don't feel like the topic is certainly open, but I think I might do something different.
Thank you.